Yeah, we are anonymous. Expect us. That's right. You're with Lorax Live at Anonymous Radio, Radio Non-Ops and Non-Plus Radio, 100.1 FM Pirate Radio, going out in SoCal. Time for our guest tonight. Rebecca Bow serves as an international privacy coordinator on EFF's international team. She remains active in the Freedom of Information Committee of the Northern California chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, which hosts an annual awards ceremony to spotlight journalists, citizens, whistleblowers, legal professionals, students, and others engaged in strengthening and upholding the freedom of information. In her spare time, Rebecca can be found exploring hiking trails along the California coastline. Can you hear me there, Rebecca?
I can hear you just fine. How are you doing tonight?
Great, great. Thanks for coming on the show. Look, we've had the pleasure of having EFF guests on several times, and most of our listeners are familiar with your work. But because it is so vital to the protection of our digital liberties, I hope you could give us a quick overview of the Electronic Frontier Foundation's mission and your role. Can you give our listeners an idea of the scope of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. And first off, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on the show. You know, it's a great opportunity. Really excited to talk about EFF's work to your listeners. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a digital civil liberties organization. We've been around for more than 20 years now, and our mission is to uphold civil liberties such as freedom of expression, the right to privacy, and you know, we have staff attorneys who engage in legislation in, you know, U.S. courts. You may have heard about our warrantless wiretapping case. That's one thing that people are, you know, hear a lot about when they hear about EFF. It is how we filed a suit against the National Security Agency and AT&T for engaging in this, you know, mass interception of Americans' communications. Mm-hmm. That's an ongoing case. We also have an activism team, an international team, which I'm a part of. And we also have technologists who are engaged in developing what we like to call freedom-enhancing technologies. So I would really encourage anyone out there who hasn't already done so to visit our website. It's EFF.org. And look for our browser plugin. It's HTTPS everywhere, which can help you to browse the web in a secure fashion.
Updates with HTTPS. TPS everywhere this week. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, our technologists have been super busy on that front. And so my role at EFF is as international privacy coordinator. I'm sort of helping to get the word out about, you know, different threats that we're seeing cropping up around the world, having to do with online privacy, and really trying to defend user privacy across the board. As you can imagine, this keeps me and my colleagues extremely busy. We are seeing proposals for new online surveillance legislation, as I'm sure you are well aware of, and other kinds of really nasty things coming up.
Yeah, for sure. You know, one of the issues that Anonymous is passionate about is user privacy. You know, since data mining is a very lucrative business, you know, there's a lot of pressure from powerful interests to chip away at our rights. You know, do you see the issue of online privacy as one that the general public is concerned with, or are most people unaware of it because, you know, data collection is stealth and media doesn't treat it as a threat as such, you know, just because it's in business and government activity?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would say that in general, I think people are beginning to be more concerned about online privacy because, you know, all you have to do is scan the headlines and you hear these horror stories. You find out that, you know, maybe your LinkedIn password has been, you know, compromised, or maybe, for example, Target's use of behavioral advertising. I don't know if you've heard about this, but there was a young girl, a teenager, who started receiving, you know, advertisements in the mail from Target, which is a major department store here in the U.S., and it was for maternity stuff. Why did she get it? Well, they were able to use behavioral advertising to figure out that she was pregnant, and this was before her parents knew. So her parents are looking and seeing why is Target sending her, you know, stuff that's targeted for, you know, pregnant women. And so, you know, these kinds of stories are, I think, you know, seeping into public consciousness. And I think people are more and more concerned, but I don't know that people are out there and saying, you know, mandatory data retention, what's happening in Australia. They probably are, because I follow the news in Australia and I see all the time that, you know, data retention is a huge pressing issue.
Yeah, well, you know, on that issue, people weren't following it until Anonymous stepped up and brought the issue to light with obviously those hacks on the major Australian ISPs releasing some data there. All redacted, of course. No one was hurt, but it did bring the issue to the forefront and made mainstream media. Another thing this week that's been big, you know, in the past week or so, the Facebook privacy situation. You know, they agreed to suspend the use of facial recognition recently, and it's been major business news this week. Primarily being a public company now, they're the way they exploit users is now under the spotlight in their business model, obviously, because they're trying to make money from it. Also, you know, can you explain the history, you know, of this tracking they use and the user pressure that led to, you know, to Facebook's decision of removing the facial recognition?
Yeah, I mean, I did actually write a little bit about that. And, you know, basically the data protection commissioners in I believe it was Germany, were really concerned about the use of this automatic tagging tool. So, you know, when you upload a photo onto Facebook, it might say, oh, is this so-and-so? And it'll automatically recognize that person's face. Well, it turns out that when they were doing that, they were also building this huge database. It's a biometric database that has all of this facial recognition information. And so the contention was that this was being done without the consent of the users, and that, you know, there it really would have been preferable, like, from, you know, the eyes of you know, the German agencies that were looking at this, to have them, you know, let people opt in, like, okay, it's okay for you to collect my facial recognition data, or it's not. I mean, give people the choice. People, I think, would probably choose not to have that kind of information collected. And, you know, this is, so facial recognition is something that we're seeing, you know, in the U.S. as well. One of our staff attorneys, Jen Lynch, actually testified before Congress recently about facial recognition and the need for stronger standards around that, because, you know, Americans don't even realize that they may actually be in a facial recognition database.
Yeah, and they are already. What we are seeing across the world now is, 35 countries signing up recently to recent data sharing laws. Some of the things that we've been putting together, information leak-wise, show, I mean, you're talking about one company, Facebook, with data recognition. When you start to group up the 250-plus companies involved in this military system as well, for instance, like with OpTrapWire, and then you start seeing 35 countries sign data sharing laws, it's a little bit more pervasive and a little bit further along than what most people think. And the law is actually just a catch-up to make these systems legal, basically. You know, by some estimates, over half of all Americans already have a face print in the national database. Australia is pushing for greater data retention rights, and the EU is filling its public places with CCTV cameras. Have we allowed government use of technology to drive privacy rights issues without public debate about these limits?
I mean, I think that there, in a lot of cases, what you're seeing is, you know, technology is evolving faster than the law. And so what you have is, you have law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies sort of going to governments and saying, oh, there's all these new modes of communication. Like, people can now communicate through Twitter and Facebook and all these different ways, and we don't even have a way to spy on them. You know, so they're asking for these broader powers to really go in and, you know, surveil people. And I think that, you know, to some extent, they would like to have it happen without a debate. But I think that there is a lot of debate. I think that people are outraged, and they have a right to be outraged by, you know, legislation and policies that are limiting privacy rights. I mean, one of the reasons that we have been so focused on Dapp Engine is because we really view this as a form of mass surveillance legislation.
Yeah.
And the reason this is so problematic is because it gets us away from an era where, you know, if somebody is suspected of committing a crime, then you have, you know, a targeted investigation on that particular individual.
Yeah.
But instead, they're having proposals where, you know, people's communication data would be stored for up to 2 full years, regardless of who you are. Even if you're suspected of no wrongdoing whatsoever, law enforcement can have access to, you know, who you sent a text message to, who you emailed, your IP address information, and your, you know, mobile location information in some cases. I mean, the laws are different all, you know, across the board. But, you know, this kind of information, even if it's not content, can reveal a really vivid portrait of your entire life.
Yeah.
And that's not acceptable. I mean, it shouldn't live in a society where everyone is treated as a suspect.
Yep, that's
just
right.
Because law enforcement have,
and that,
you know,
and that is the way that's happening. I mean, we're talking about a point you made before, the basically international digital rights standards to address. I've talked before about well, just some general philosophies being introduced to our governments that can drive good policy when it comes to our digital rights. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's something I think, because we're not going to better stop the technology advance. In fact, a lot of us within Anonymous are, you know, developers in other lives. You know, we're involved in development of technology. We're not going to stop the development of technology, but what we can prevent is the misuse of you know, that technology. And that's something that we have to enforce on our governments to make the correct decisions now, draw a line on the sand with certain issues, and make sure they adhere to certain principles. You know, look, here in Australia, there have been major efforts to quickly expand data retention.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
This is a global problem, you know, and are the data retention policies simply shifting, you know, government roles to third-party telecommunications companies? You talked just then about 2 years, but that's 2 years with a government-monitored situation. When we have these connections between these, you know, black op, you might say, or private companies working alongside government companies, the law, mm-hmm. they're working somewhat outside of those monitoring situations, aren't they?
I mean, I guess so. I'm not really sure.
Okay. Well, yeah, it is this global problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they're simply, you know, shifting government roles to third-party telecommunications companies, i.e. like Facebook being held back.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. So the idea that they would try to sort of employ, you know, internet service providers or major internet companies as agents of law enforcement by forcing them to retain this information. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a huge problem. It's, you know, it's also a problem for if you have someone who wants to provide, you know, a small, you know, ISP, for example. You know, I have some friends here in San Francisco who run a local ISP. They're great people. And, you know, if you told them that they had to start storing everyone's communications data and all of their history, they'd go out of business. I mean, they wouldn't be able to afford the cost of even just retaining that information.
That's exactly
so it really
right.
gives an advantage. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you got that.
Another thing.
Yeah, go on.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, another thing that we have seen sort of internationally is, you know, you mentioned Australia and the data retention proposal there. You know, recently the Attorney General submitted a letter saying that she was clarifying this proposal, which I'm sure you've been following this. And it was mostly copying and pasting from the European Union data retention directive. And that is a policy that has been, I mean, people have been up in arms challenging that all across Europe ever since 2006 when it was first passed. Even the German Constitutional Court found that that framework was unconstitutional. And I actually have a quote here I want to read, which was from the German Constitutional Court. They said, blanket retention is capable of creating a diffusely threatening feeling of being watched, which can impair a free exercise of fundamental rights in many areas. I mean, I think that that's like a great way of seeing, like, this is just creepy.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. It's a great word, creepy, because that's exactly what it is. And we see it. Yeah, one of the biggest problems, and we see a great example of it with the Clean IT leak the other week and the Clean IT situation, you know, where basically it's a fear-driven industry. You've got a handful of software developers trying to cash in on a situation driven by fear, and the only conversations, the only debate that is being stirred up in the Clean IT situation is by the same people trying to push dodgy software products to make a profit. And the whole debate is coming from a one-sided angle. And unfortunately, it just doesn't stack up. I mean, we're using, you know, there's been many examples around the world where, you know, terrorism has been used to increase surveillance, and many examples where it just has failed. You know, last month there was a lot of discussion of the UK Communications Bill, dubbed Snooper's Charter, you know, that required data generation specifically and exclusively for law enforcement purposes. Critics called it a blueprint for totalitarian regimes to impose a surveillance state. What was the main aim, and what are the risks with this type of intrusion of governments into cyberspace?
Yeah, I mean, and the UK Snooper's Charter is a great example of something that's even going beyond, like, the EU Data Retention Directive and giving law enforcement even broader online spying powers. And, you know, as you rightly pointed out, I mean, this would require law enforcement agencies to actually retain information it would compel internet service providers to actually retain information specifically for law enforcement purposes. So, you know, it's like building a file on everybody just so that law enforcement can have access to it if they want it. And, you know, this is something that part of the proposal is to sort of log people's online, you know, browsing histories too. And Jimmy Wales, you know, the founder of Wikipedia, went to weigh in on this publicly. And he said, you know, if you do this, we'll encrypt all of our communications to Britain, because we think that what you're doing really undermines the humanity of what we're trying to do. I mean, they're like, we're trying to offer a free encyclopedia to the world. And we think that what people about on Wikipedia is their business. And it shouldn't be, you know, up to us to, you know, turn over to the government what, you know, what people are reading about on Wikipedia. Why should they care?
I think there was a book written about it all. It was called 1984. Yeah, anyway. I think there was a book written, yeah, it's a joke, a bad one. Oh, look, let's talk about OpTrapWire. You know, it's an anonymous operation, you know, tracking a massive integration of online data, biometrics, facial recognition, transportation systems, and CCTV cameras. You know, what makes it so enormous? You know, and as a Big Brother spying network, and it's run by contractors all over the world. One of the things that came about in OpTrapWire was, well, the number of countries involved and the number of private contractors involved was huge. You know, in September, the EFF participated in a Freedom Not Fear protest targeting exactly these violations of individual privacy. What has been the greatest success in this area, and what remains the greatest challenge?
So Freedom Not Fear was an international gathering of activists, and they actually had events all over the world. I mean, the primary thing was in Brussels, but they also had stuff in Argentina, and I believe in Sydney as well. And it's, you know, folks who are concerned about these issues and who are concerned about surveillance. And, you know, they were really focused on CCTV cameras, as you mentioned, the sort of proliferation of CCTV in the UK was a major issue. And, you know, the idea of pushing back against data retention. And I really like the message there. I mean, Freedom Not Fear, I think, is something that's really worth sort of repeating and adhering to, because, you know, a fear-based climate is not good for anybody, least of all activists. And if you really focus on, you know, upholding freedom, like freedom of expression, right to privacy, you know, the right of people who are, you know, involved in organizations of political dissent to communicate with one another and organize and push back against really bad government policies. I mean, that those freedoms are really, really crucial, and that's what we're trying to protect here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they, the Freedom Not Fear activists, one thing that they did was to form an international working group on CCTV. And this is one issue that's been interesting to me, because one thing we've seen in the UK is the use of this new app called FaceWatch. Have you heard about FaceWatch?
No, I haven't actually. Do tell.
So it's kind of interesting. It's a company that's partnering with law enforcement. And they have an app that anybody can download. And you can sort of search, this is within the UK, you can search by zip code.
Yeah.
And it'll bring up images of people that were captured on CCTV cameras, that law enforcement has gone around, collected all these images, and they're using it to target the rioters who were involved, you know, in the London riots last year. And so it doesn't give you any information about who this person was or you know, what they're suspected of doing, but it shows you an image of a face from a camera. And if you are somebody, you know, who's downloaded this app, you can actually send information straight to the police.
So it's sort of like an app for Crime Stoppers sort of thing. You're like, have you seen these people?
It's really creepy. I found it so creepy.
It is very creepy. You know, and talking about these different systems that are being implemented, you know, one of the assumptions, you know, that lawmakers want, and I'll get onto policies later on, big personal thing here with that. One of the assumptions that lawmakers seem to have is that technology is a foolproof tool. You know, even though Anonymous continues to prove all digital realms have vulnerabilities, you know, there is a perception that law enforcement can rely on accuracy with higher technology tools like iris recognition, and they want to store our data, but we prove, you know, it's not safe to store. You know, have there been developments that show even these systems, you know, can be fooled, or skilled hackers, you know, can subvert them? And is vulnerability of systems given a realistic consideration by lawmakers?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you asked that question, because, you know, one thing that we have been looking at is, you know, we've been really focused on biometric identification systems. And at the Black Hat Security Conference this past summer, researchers actually showed that it is possible to spoof a biometric iris scanner.
Yep.
So this is supposedly the most foolproof way of authenticating someone's identity, is that you stand in front of this thing, it scans your eye, and, you know, this algorithm says it's definitely you. But, you know, these research showed that there's a way to use this. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea how they do it, but it's algorithms and iterations, and they can come up with an image that will actually trick this machine and grant access to people. I mean, there's, you know, I think it's been shown time and again that there, you know, there isn't the security that they believe exists doesn't actually exist. I mean, it's sort of an illusion.
It is an illusion. Anything put into an algorithm can be cracked at some point in time. That is the point. I mean, you've got to convert, first of all, that iris image into a key point match system, and then all you're going to do is replicate that algorithm, which does that conversion basically. You know, it's quite a scary thing, but yeah. You know, yeah, and talking about this is something that we think within some of us within Anonymous anyway think that we should be using the next stage to help lawmakers try and see the light when it comes to coming up with good policy in digital rights. You know, and talking about that, you know, something that was leaked this week was the WCIT, or the World Conference on Telecommunication. It has been dubbed the most important event that people have never heard of. We're talking about, it's true. Nobody ever heard of it until
right.
It was sort of leaked this week. You know, those that have not, that have been trying to get additional information have had their freedom of information request denied about this too. I know it's not your area of specialization, but can you tell the listeners in general terms why this WCIT meeting raises concerns for digital rights groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So we pronounce it WICIT. It's the World Conference on International Telecommunication And basically, it's this meeting that's going to be coming up in December in Dubai. And it's a United Nations agency called the International Telecommunications Union. So they historically have, you know, just governed telecommunications networks across the board. And they're going to be revisiting this treaty. It's called, sorry, this is a lot of acronyms, but yep. It's called the International Telecommunication Regulations. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time since the internet was, you know, basically in existence that they are revisiting this, you know, these particular regulations. And the fear is that it's going to broaden in scope and that it could affect the internet in ways that would get us away from the model that has been so, you know, so successful so far, like this decentralized, you know, fostering democratic participation, you know, good for all kinds of cultural exchange and creativity and innovation. The fear is that it will take us away from that and into this more sort of bureaucratic, top-down, you know, kind of structure of yeah. rulemaking around the internet. And, you know, this is sort of like, I mean, you remember the ACTA protests and how the European Parliament rejected ACTA earlier this spring. I mean, that was a rejection not just to IP policies, but to the idea that these secretive, you know, government and corporate, you know, organizations were going to make decisions behind closed doors that affect the internet.
Yep.
I mean, people, you know, users everywhere are really sick of having these hierarchical, you know, just really powerful agencies making decisions that mess with the internet without them.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason people are so worried about the ITU is because there is a lack of democratic participation. The ITU is made of 193 member states, but that's governments. And then they also have these sort of non-voting members. And these are some of the world's largest telecommunications companies.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, industry and government together making decisions that are designed to, you know, increase profits and you know, I mean, there are some good things that the ITU does. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
It's not like a total evil agency, but, you know, that we are concerned because we don't believe that they are the right forum for decisions about the internet to be
That's
made.
That's right. Well, it's just another example of, you know, the corruption of policy making that comes when governments and corporations work together. Like I said, trying to give an example with that CleanNet situation where you have a handful of companies pushing products, you know, and using fear to push mm-hmm. those products, and then policy being driven, you know, by those, you know, by that handful of voices, basically. It's just ludicrous. Yeah, you know, does the fact that the WCIT agreement, you know, is based on ancient telephone and telegraph communication make it particularly bad framework to use for a modern digital rights or digital rights policies?
Yeah. I mean, and that's the point, really, is that, you know, there's these sort of outmoded rules and rulemaking that are fine for the telecommunications network, but they can't be directly applied to the internet. You know, some of the more troubling policies or provisions that have been proposed are, you know, government regulation of IP traffic routing, some content-related proposals we've seen that are focused on spam and fraud, but nevertheless, that's something that's, you know, veering into content regulation on the internet. And so it's anyone's guess, you know, sort of they're trying to throw everything at the wall to see what will stick. And we don't really know what the outcome is going to be,
yep.
but we're really concerned that it could be something that has a negative impact overall on, you know, functioning of the internet, and that, you know, that wonderful sort of decentralized, you know, sort of lightweight, nimble kind of structure that we've had so far could be, you know, kind of bogged down in this new kind of bureaucratic regime.
Yeah. So, and what it's something funny too, really. I mean, just the whole ignorance on what the internet is, I suppose, is something that I laugh about. What they don't realize is the more they try and control, because it's the internet is not an island you can just put a fence around. You know, it was created. It's a space that was
yeah.
created mostly by hackers, mind you, too. I mean, in the true sense of hacking. it's a space which has been corrupted by corporations first. I mean, if you go back to the internet and its inception, it was just about information sharing, and beautiful spaces were created by individuals, you know, usually tech-savvy individuals and education departments or groups to share information. It started to get corrupted probably in the 90s, the mid-90s, where corporations got involved, and then, you know, it was all about how they could profit from this space. And now you've got governments scrambling with corporations to continue this profit-driven situation. What they don't realise is if they mess with the internet, we'll just switch off the DNS systems and use something like an OpenNIC DNS system, where you'll have a fragmented internet. You'll have a corporate internet which no one will use, a bit like Twitter at the moment, which is just driven by PR companies. And you'll have a separate internet, which will be the true internet, running off a totally separate DNS system like OpenNIC. It's just a ridiculous framework that has no place, you know, basically. Now, look, because Anonymous is a defender of internet freedom, you know, we have a neutral support, a natural support, sorry, for the work EFF does on the legislative and journalistic side of the battle. You know, is there anything you could recommend for our listeners who want to offer support to you in legal traditional ways?
Oh, awesome. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to get involved and to, you know, sort of help us in our work of defending online freedom. You know, you can start by visiting our website, EFF.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us at, you know, just at EFF on Twitter. We're membership based, and so it's awesome when we get new members. You can sign up for our newsletter. There's, you know, all kinds of ways to connect. We also have action alerts on our website. And if you go online and you go to EFF.org and look at our, you know, there's our Deep Links blog. Let's see. I'm trying to like go online and explain exactly how to find our stuff. Yep. But action alerts are great ways to, you know, participate in our campaigns. Oh, okay. So when you go to the top, you look all the way to the right and it says take action. And that'll show you all of the different campaigns we have running. It's a really sort of relatively easy way to get involved.
Yeah. That's a great organization, the EFF. Been in, I've been around since its inception, basically. And look, I really hope the EFF pushes forward with its push to make governments adopt, good philosophy when dealing with digital privacy legislation. I also hope the EFF can work with other groups and really get behind, making the WCIT agreement become transparent and having, so the world can have some input into that. And look, I hope we can chat to you again. Is there anything else we haven't touched on that you'd like to tell us about?
I guess the last thing that I would say that, as part of EFF's international team, I'm always looking for opportunities to connect with people who are working on these issues, you know, across the world. And just as we're seeing governments borrow from one another to enact bad legislation, I think that we need to all partner up and collaborate and find our own strategies that are effective at countering these really terrible proposals and defending freedom together. So, anyone who wants to, come and chat with EFF and connect with us, I'd totally encourage you to get in touch.
Yeah, I love that idea. Likewise, I'd like to keep in touch with you too and maybe get you back on the show from time to time to give us some updates on campaigns and hopefully we can get some support for each other going, basically. We both agree on the same thing. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Collaboration. You can follow Rebecca at by Rebecca Bow on Twitter. Or like she said, make sure you go to the www.eff.org, the EFF's website, and check it out and get involved in campaigns. Look, great to have you on the show, Rebecca.
Well, thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Yeah, it was. Thank you very much. That was Rebecca Bauer from the EFF. You're with Lorax Live on Anonymous Radio, Radio Non-Ops and Anon Plus Radio, 100.1 FM Pirate Radio.